Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 8th of March. Professor Julian Zelizer is our guest the first hour of today's program, one of our favorite guests. He is a prolific writer and commentator, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He is the author and editor of all kinds of books that examine U.S. political leaders, policies, and institutions since the New Deal. Those include Jimmy Carter, part of the American President series, The Presidency of George W. Bush, A First Historical Assessment, Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. And as I look at a list of all that he has talked about and written since, well, heck, it's just since late 2010, it's page after page after page after page. So he's thinking fairly deeply, very deeply, about a number of topics, including Wisconsin. One of his recent columns on CNN.com is titled "Liberal Tradition is Under Assault." He also has written about President Obama and how he may be difficult to beat in the year 2012. What's wrong with presidential rankings? And the list goes on. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Professor Zelizer. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Professor Julian Zelizer, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. I'd like your comments on Wisconsin first. Day after day after day after day, and it's reached the point now, I'm afraid, where people are just yelling at each other. We're just clashing, and I can't imagine what the outcome will be. What are your thoughts about what's going on in this state?
Well, I think it's a pretty significant battle, and that's why, you know, it's taken on national implications rather quickly. Part of this is the issue that states are facing about how to fix their budgets, with some people wanting to focus on pensions and collective bargaining, others wanting to focus on tax incentives and other forms of spending. But it's also a question about the role of unions, and I think that's part of why this is so heated. The governor is going after the collective bargaining rights of state workers, and I think that has been seen by some as an attack on the right to unionization, which goes back to the 1930s. And so unions are fighting a tough battle to protect this.
Did they pick the wrong state, do you think, to have this battle because of Wisconsin's progressive tradition, at least some time ago, progressive tradition?
Well, maybe. You know, Wisconsin has a mix of a very strong progressive tradition dating back to the early 20th century, but also conservative tradition. So the two clash, and what happens is what you're seeing right now in the state capital. That said, in some of the more conservative states, you wouldn't have very strong unions. So you might have had a kind of quick symbolic victory, but it wouldn't have the impact that you'll get if they are able to break the back of unions in a state like Wisconsin or New Jersey or Indiana.
Is there a historical precedent for what's going on here, where increasingly you're finding that public opinion polls, even from conservative pollsters, are finding that the majority, and it varies from a vast majority to a solid majority of people in this state, want the right to collectively bargain?
Yeah, I mean, I have been surprised, to be honest, about the polls. They're quite consistent and pretty strong in favor of collective bargaining, even though there's concerns about pensions. I think the two are separate issues. But in the end, it's not that surprising. I mean, we talk about unions as almost this other thing that's lurking in state capitals or in Washington, D.C., but union members are people we all know or who are us. And I think many families depend on jobs that are obtained and protected through unions. So it's some of the dilemma conservatives often face, that in the abstract, everyone's in favor of attacking this, attacking that. But when then you look on paper at what would be cut, people start to feel very differently.
Mm-hmm. If you already have one, pension contributions increasing, health care contributions increasing, why is it in the interest, or they believe it's in the interest of the Republicans to hold on to collective bargaining?
Why do Republicans want to do that?
Yeah, why are they making that a be-all, end-all issue?
Oh, yeah, I think because it's a much broader fight. This isn't about the state budgets, and I think people like Walker, Governor Christie, or Daniels are fighting a bigger fight. The fact that they're stuck on collective bargaining suggests to many conservatives and liberals that this is not just a fight about balancing the budget. It's a fight about political power. Unions are seen as generally supporting the Democratic Party, and I think Republicans in some of these bluer states are making a strong push to undercut something that's been central to the Democratic coalition since 1935, and this is a big play right now to go after them.
Do you think that Christie is a much more popular political figure than Walker, and if so, why?
Yeah, right now he seems to be. You know, Christie has managed to develop this public persona that many people find appealing, even when he's saying the same things as Walker.
Mm-hmm.
And being very tough, he has more humor. You know, there's something anomalous about him coming out of New Jersey that people like, and he's kind of somehow a tough talker that sounds fair. I think Walker sometimes has appeared to be just strident and ideological, while Christie gives the impression of being very practical and just trying to get the state's business done. So I think there is a difference. I don't know why. I think it's just partly how they're perceived in the press.
You wrote a recent piece on conservatives saying in one of the most unexpected moments from the past few weeks, some defenders of Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's attack on public unions have pointed to FDR.
Yes, that's been something we have seen many times. There was a letter that FDR wrote in which he expressed his hesitations in the mid-1930s toward unionizing federal workers. Now, it's an odd person to take up as your champion because FDR, you know, turned into the key figure in the White House, obviously, in the unionization of workers. He was a very strong proponent of collective bargaining. He helps pass the National Labor Relations Act, which creates the NLRB, gives unions the right to bargain. And my guess is that, you know, in the post-war period, had he lived, like many Americans, he would have probably accepted the right of public workers to unionize as well. In the 40s and 50s, this was something that was very widespread. So to take the person who was at the heart of allowing workers to unionize and using him as a symbol in this fight from the right is a bit odd.
Mm-hmm. You also point to the fact that unions have been the strongest supporters of other kinds of progressive policies, health care and education reform.
That is true. During the 1960s, for example, the AFL-CIO is central in the fight for the Civil Rights Act of 1964. They were central in the fight for Medicare. Most recently, with the passage of the health care bill, unions were very important in the final stages when there were questions about whether Pelosi could maintain her coalition in convincing some on the left to accept a plan that was more pragmatic than what they wanted and more limited than they wanted. So unions have always played a role, in some ways a bigger role, not in obtaining rights for their workers, but in helping to pass more liberal legislation in other areas.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that obviously there are people nationally who are looking at what's going on in Wisconsin and considering the fact that the presidential election is not all that far away? Are they saying, well, this strategy of dumping collective bargaining is not working out as well as we thought? It will not be one of our major strategies in winning the presidency.
Well, I think there's a split. I do think there are some Republicans right now who believe that even on issues where the polls are not with them and where they might be moving, you know, beyond what their own constituency is prepared for, that that's the way to go. What they're looking for is a sort of ideological purity and political strength and confidence that has been lacking in the Republican Party. And so I think some look at this and say, no, this is the right fight to have, just like, you know, fighting to cut Social Security. But there are other Republicans who constantly remember the mid-1990s when Republicans took over Congress, shut down the government, and went too far, and it backfired. And so I think you have both elements and both ideas circulating in the GOP right now.
And what does it say about the strength or lack thereof of the Democratic Party that what's happened here is Democratic senators have, as you well know, moved to Illinois, which is now the subject of endless jokes, although there is a great deal of admiration for those senators as well. That's what they're left with, that to keep a bill from passing, they just simply have to remove themselves from the state.
Yeah, it doesn't speak well. That's what disempowered parties do. You know, their last hope is to just run away and hope no one can take a vote. And I think, you know, again, nationally, that's not what it looks good in terms of trying to gauge where the Democrats are. If that's really all they have left, it's not good for Democrats in Wisconsin. At the same time, it also, I think, even more reflects a certain ambivalence Democrats have about defending unions. Many Democrats in the last two decades have moved away from some of the bread and butter issues that had been central to the Democratic Party in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. They have this ambivalent relationship with unions in the past few decades, where they focus more on suburban voters, on social issues, and not on these classic issues of workers' rights. And so I think they're running away because they have no power, but they're also running away because they don't know how to handle this issue anymore. They've lost their way in some ways when it comes to unions and workers.
I don't think anybody knows how to handle this issue. I don't think too many people, correct me if you have a different perception, saw that this was going to happen, that you would have tens of thousands of people marching in Madison, that there are meetings trying to take place in Wisconsin, and people are yelling at each other, so they have to stop the meetings in mid-course. Congressman Sensenbrenner had a meeting in Wauwatosa last night where people were incredibly upset. This is a Republican district in Wisconsin. I mean, everything seems to be up for grabs.
Absolutely. No one saw the crisis coming. No one really saw the move by governors coming. I think there's always a lot of rhetoric about going after unions and cuts, but you didn't see it happen. And finally, no one saw the backlash, and no one saw people from the state and from outside the state turning this into a huge, huge issue that's really dominated Wisconsin politics and national politics. I think everyone's trying to figure out where to go, but there is a lot of grassroots energy on both sides and very heated feelings about how this is going to be resolved.
Yeah. What about the issue of deficit reduction? Have the Republicans made this the issue that it is now in this country, and should it be the number one issue?
Well, there are divisions about that. Everyone's in favor of deficit reduction, but not everyone's in favor of making that a priority right now. The argument is we are still in a very bad economic situation, and we are still in a recession, and that this is not the time to balance the budget. We still need the stimulus that government provides. So there are Democrats who are arguing that, so not everyone's on board with this push. But I do think Republicans have succeeded. They made this an issue in the months leading up to the 2010 midterm. It's seen as President Obama's greatest vulnerability, just because when you see the numbers, they're unsettling. And you can make all the economic arguments you want, but I think there's some political traction you gain by saying we can't have deficits this high. And I think the debate has shifted. It's now about how to cut the deficit, not when to cut the deficit or not whether to cut the deficit. And this will put President Obama in a bit of a defensive position in the months ahead in terms of setting the agenda.
When you write, the politics of deficit reduction usually don't work in favor of liberalism. Tell me more. What do you mean?
Well, liberalism is about using government, and deficit reduction is about cutting government. And even though Democrats have often been as hawkish on deficits as Republicans, when you really look at the record, it's still not, what Democrats want to be focusing on, because it usually will entail cutting spending, containing spending, and preventing the growth even of existing programs. And so it's hard to do much with government when you're focused on cutting the deficit. It's also could have bad effects on the economy in the short term. And so there are, again, liberals who say this is not the time to end the stimulus are worried that this will hurt the very workers who they want to show their administration has helped. So I think liberals and Democrats could be vulnerable if this continues to be issue number one.
Creeping into news stories now in the past week are indications, and I don't know how meaningful they are, Professor Zelizer, that the economy is on the uptick here, that unemployment is down a little bit. You're getting reports of people who are hiring hundreds of workers or 40 workers, where before it was all doom and gloom. Are we seeing the economy change? Is it getting better?
Well, it's some sunshine, but it's not a lot. So there is some evidence that, you know, the bottom is gone. We're not in the bottom of the recession anymore, and there is some positive movement on jobs. The problem is we are so deep in this ditch that those kind of numbers won't mean much to most Americans at this point. You still have very high unemployment numbers. So there is some benefit politically, obviously, to the president and to the Democrats to show we're moving away from where we were in the fall of 2008. But I don't think we're still at the numbers right now that, you know, politicians can be very comfortable. The public is still very frustrated and very scared with this economy.
And where does the price of oil factor into all of this with all that's going on in Libya and the Mideast? Those prices have just shot up in the last month. What does that mean?
Not good. You know, that's the one problem that always angers people. When oil goes up in this country, people get mad.
Right.
You can always count on that. We do tolerate a lot of stuff, but we want cheap oil. And so, you know, again, members of both parties are very nervous about this because it's a very tangible measure that Americans, employed and unemployed, can have about how things are going. And when they go to fill up their gas and the price is much more than it was 2 weeks earlier, they're going to be upset and they might start talking politics. So this is something I think the Democrats and Republicans have a close eye on.
And are there a wide range of ideas about what the United States should do in Libya?
No. I think there's a kind of drift that we're seeing in Washington right now. The whole Middle East uprisings have taken the administration, both parties, by surprise. And the biggest problem isn't just that these uprisings are taking place, is that they are very different in each country. They have very different impetus, different potential outcomes. They're facing very different kind of government leaders. And I don't think there's a policy. There's no doctrine in the Middle East right now other than watch and wait. Obama has made some comments that he thinks revolutions are better if they're organic, if they're internal, because as soon as the United States interferes, it becomes an issue about American involvement. But that's not really a policy. That's just watching. So it's unclear what we're going to do. And in Libya, I think we're seeing a civil war develop. The government is not stepping down. Gaddafi is delusional and brutal. And that's a dangerous combination. And so I think they might force the hand of the United States to say something or to do something.
We go to phone calls in just one moment. Professor Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, is our guest this hour. He has written extensively, just to give you an idea of some of the news columns he's done. Will Obama be tough to beat? Liberal tradition is under assault. What's wrong with presidential rankings? Middle East changes may defy history. Should the top U.S. goal be democracy? Reagan the politician. Can Republicans cut defense spending? Did Obama get his message across after the State of the Union, that was? What Obama can learn from Clinton and Reagan? He's a presidential scholar, and he's also focused his attention on Wisconsin because what's happening in this state is pretty big and is part of a broader fight. So let's scurry to your phone calls in a moment. Here's the number. A couple lines are open. They won't be open for long. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And the email address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, hour number two of our program. This is a fascinating story. The book is Ugly Beauty, Helena Rubinstein, L'Oreal, and the Blemished History of Looking Good. The guy who founded L'Oreal was a Nazi sympathizer, and Helena Rubinstein was Jewish growing up in Poland. She became the first millionaire, female millionaire in this country. And it looks not only at the beauty industry and how you can charge oodles of money for something that costs nothing to put together, but why it is that we use these products, the politics, particularly of the guy who founded L'Oreal, what was going on in World War II. She looks at plastic surgery and Botox and all of that as well, and some of the interests that Helena Rubinstein had in the glands of monkeys to make people look better. I didn't know if I'd like it or not, and I was just fascinated. Incredible stories. So that's our number two. Our guest is the author of that book. She's a very well-known British cultural historian. All right, two phone calls for Professor Julian Zelizer. Let's go to Jerry in Madison first. Hi, Jerry.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that I don't believe that this budget repair bill or the emergency bill or any form of it would have or does have any redeeming social or economic value, and it should be killed. And to those Democratic senators who I'm sure are tuned in daily, I would say hang in there. You're our last great hope. So thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. And yet, I want to hear your take on this. What happened in Wisconsin was fairly dramatic. We got the assembly in the hands of Republicans and the governor, which is unusual. Did people not vote in the last election, or what was going on?
No, people did vote, and I think we have to take the vote seriously. And the governor is responding to some real sentiment that's out there. And both the antagonism to unions and the concerns about the budget are real. I just think, you know, as in most elections at the national and state level, the winner doesn't reflect the whole population. That's the problem with mandates. The winner just reflects the majority. But you can have a very strong minority and a majority which is divided on issues. And when they come together, a governor can overstep. And that's what many Democrats are wondering, whether that just happened. And so I think that's how you interpret the election. This happens all the time, and this is why in Washington you always hear members of Congress after a midterm saying, be careful, don't read too much into this, or even after presidential elections. You have to remember a lot of the country didn't vote for the existing president.
Right.
And that's always the case.
Would it, for his political future, because I'm sure he's a young guy, he would like to go on in politics, would it behoove him at this point, I can't see anybody budging, for him to say, all right, we're just going to deal with collective bargaining at some other time. I can't imagine him saying that, but would politically that be helpful to our governor, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's actually a smarter political move to make. He's made his point. He's made his stand clear. And there's always room for a politician to say, I did the best I can. But there's divisions on this issue. And, you know, people will say that's flip-flopping. People will say he has no backbone. On the other hand, that's what skilled politicians do. They take a stand. They do something dramatic. But when they see, you know, not all the public is with them and there's a significant opposition, they're willing to negotiate to back down. Here you have this split in Wisconsin, the pension issue and the collective bargaining issue. By conflating them, I think he's creating more political problems than he would otherwise have received. And I do think there's room for him to back down. And I don't think the public would be unforgiving if he did that and wanted, you know, to run at a national level at some point.
And what about the president? What about Obama? Has he done that? Has he backed down?
All the time. You know, on issues, he's constantly backing down. And I don't say that critically. George Bush did the same thing. You know, Obama took a strong stand for a bold health care bill. And by the end, it was significantly watered down with many compromises. And he's done that on issue after issue. He's also been a bit hesitant on the Wisconsin issue, saying, again, he supports the unions, but he also supports cuts in spending. And, you know, Obama does have problems, but I'm not sure that's the reason they exist. Most politicians have to do that. That's politics. It's about compromise. It's about the art of the possible. And so there comes a moment when a politician like Governor Walker has to realize that he will need to compromise like everyone else who's come before him.
Thanks, Jerry, for the call. Claire in Milwaukee. Hi, Claire.
Hi. First of all, I would like to agree with that last comment about Walker should probably pick his battles and separate them a little bit. I've been in support of most of what he's proposed, but I think he needs to negotiate a little bit. But the question I'm calling with, I've been wondering for a while exactly what happens on a more personal level to the general public when we have such huge deficits, either at the state or the federal level, because I don't think people really see any kind of change in services or anything in their lives besides the job market and the recession. I just want to know exactly what happens when the deficit just keeps climbing and we don't do anything about it.
Well, you know, one negative thing is obviously money is squeezed from the development of new programs. So if you look at the national level, we are so focused on pre-existing commitments, such as Social Security and Medicare and the military, and on deficit and debt reduction, that there are new needs that just won't get funded because of this. And there's, you know, arguments about what deficits at the national level do to interest rates and what they'll do to financial and housing markets. But again, there are many economists who don't think, you know, we are Greece right now, and think our economy can sustain this in the short term and, in fact, might need this kind of stimulus. We had deficits in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. This was a period where the government ran deficits frequently, and it was also one of the kind of great moments in American economic history. And for many Americans, it was an era when the middle class became obtainable for the first time. So some of the warnings, I think, are often far in excess in terms of what's going to happen to people at the personal level than the reality suggests. And finally, deficit reduction has very serious costs on individuals. So at the state level, when you're making spending cuts, as you'll see in Wisconsin, as we'll see all over the country, it's going to have real impact. That means your kid's class is gone, or, you know, a bunch of teachers right. in a school are gone. And we need to look at that and the costs that come from that as well.
Yeah, that's very troublesome to a lot of people, I think, because we all access education. We go to school.
Well, you see it at the state level, deficit reduction in much clearer fashion, or spending cuts, because, you know, there's less money. You're not talking at these abstract budgets that you hear about in Washington. You'll see your kid's teacher removed or shifted or a program shut down. And I think that can be also dangerous for those pushing for the cuts.
And Claire, when you said you would like to see the governor negotiate a bit, what are you referencing particularly?
Particularly the collective bargaining issue. My husband is actually a teacher in Milwaukee Public Schools, and we're of the very small minority of teachers who actually support what Walker is trying to do. But I've just been thinking if he really is going after this, saying that if we don't get rid of collective bargaining, they're just going to bargain everything right back or find other ways to get more money out of the state and out of the system. It just seems to me if he waited a few years, let the bill go through without the collective bargaining issue, and then maybe the unions will weasel more money out of it is probably what he's thinking. And then he can say, see, look, this is why I wanted to get rid of it, and then attack it when it's more clear to the public.
Thanks, Claire, very much for your call. Roseanne is next in Milwaukee. Hi, Roseanne.
Hi. I have a question. Well, actually, I'm a teacher as well, and am, you know, very concerned about what's going to happen to education. But my question to Professor Salazar is related to the orchestration of the message that the Republicans are so good at. And I'm wondering to what extent Professor Salazar thinks that there's some Machiavellian sort of Rovian policy that the Republicans are using with this budget cutback in order to halt any gains that might be made in Obama's recovery program.
Yeah, I mean, are they pushing for the deficit to somehow slow down the economy and retake the White House? That would be a Machiavellian move, and it would be the kind of thing one would expect Karl Rove to think about. I'm not sure they're doing that. You know, the many Republicans realize if the economy is not good, they are vulnerable as well, especially members of Congress. They've been through enough swings that they realize that. I do think there's a genuine belief in cutting spending and cutting government that you don't need that rationale to support if you're a Republican. So I don't know if there's evidence they're doing that. I've heard other people make this argument as well. And Republicans always used to say this about Democrats, too, that, you know, you want to slow down a recession going into an election because it's going to, you know, benefit the opposition party. But at this point, you know, we can't say that's the case. And unless there's some evidence that I'm not aware of, I think this is more a genuine ideological debate about the role of government in the 21st century.
Let's look ahead, because it seems like it's closer now to the 2012 race. Is Obama going to be very hard to beat?
Absolutely. It's a combination of the difficulty of beating an incumbent president, which hasn't happened very often. It's been, you know, President Carter, President George H.W. Bush, and Gerald Ford, who had unusual circumstances, given, you know, he came in after Nixon resigned, who have been defeated. And that's it. You know, Truman and LBJ stepped down voluntarily. We don't know what would have happened otherwise. I think many Republicans know the history. They also know that the Republican field is not very strong right now. There's no candidate who clearly could take him on. And, you know, if the economy continues to move even in a slightly positive direction, that still makes things harder for Republicans, even if things are still bad. So I think you've seen in the past month many people going on TV and talking about maybe going and running, from Newt Gingrich to Donald Trump, but none of them almost are saying, I'm going to run. And I think many are leery that they can actually beat Obama in 2012.
Hmm. And what about Roseanne's point, and I think it's a good one, that the Republicans do seem to have a very effective orchestration of message and the Democrats don't?
I think there's truth to that. We've seen that in the first few years of the Obama presidency. I think that the Republicans consistently dominated and shaped the public debate over issues. They turned Obama into a socialist. They characterized this health care bill as something much bigger than it actually was. And they were quite effective leading into 2010 at staying on message. And keeping that theme even when criticized. Republicans are very good at that. And that's not Machiavellian. That's just political strategy. They've honed those skills over the past two decades. It is coordinated through the media, through the conservative media, and the Republican Party. And I don't think Democrats have, you know, replicated what Republicans have been able to do. So even when they win office, they often don't win the message wars, so to speak. And I think it's somewhere Democrats need to become stronger if they want to, you know, compete over public debate and how the public sees issues.
Thanks, Roseanne. Al in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
All right, how are you, Al?
Okay.
Good.
I wish that WPR would spend a lot more time recently in pointing out that Walker was elected with, what, 28% of the vote that could have voted? A million people stayed home. Please hammer on this, because just like the guest said a few minutes ago, Walker won the election. Yes, he won the election with 28% of the vote. That 28% of the vote represents probably that hard right wing that controls the media, that is able to get its message across. So maybe the last hope we have is something like public radio to set the record straight. Would you please point this out so that maybe that million people who didn't vote in the last election gets the word somehow? I don't know if they're going to get the word over WPR, but we just have to get that message out.
Okay. All right, Al. Thanks. Thanks for the call. Here's an email that's come in from Carol in Verona. And this she found in UW Professor Stanley Cutler, the Nixon expert, I'm sure you know who he is, in his current Truth Dig article. Governor Walker does something big. He writes, in 1967, Wisconsin Republicans controlled the Assembly 53-47 and the state Senate 21-12. Warren Knowles, a longtime Republican, was governor, and this triumvirate granted state employees the right to bargain collectively. So much for current Republican charges that Democrats pander to unions.
Well, that's I don't know that history, but it's not surprising. And again, until recently, until the past couple of decades, the right to collective bargaining was something that many people in both parties had come to accept. And, you know, there was a hard right going back to the 1930s that opposed it, but there were many more Americans who thought this should be part of what the country is about and part of how the workplace is organized. And it developed for very real reasons. Workers faced dangerous conditions. The public sector workers were often underpaid for what they did. It was an incentive to attract good workers. And so it's not surprising that Republicans in Wisconsin, even with, you know, a more progressive element that's always existed there, would have accepted this. I think the Republican Party has changed. It has shifted to the right. And Governor Walker is reflecting where many in the GOP are right now.
Can you please comment? A lot of people in this state were concerned about the access that this prank caller, who said he was David Koch, had to Governor Walker and the conversation that ensued, and the Democrats are filing ethics charges here against the governor for this call. Were you disturbed by people who do have a lot of money having access, and does it say something that we need to really look at Citizens United and who has access to politicians, be they Democrats or Republicans? A lot of people were troubled by that.
Absolutely. I mean, this is not an issue raised by the call. Meaning the problems of campaign finance and the way in which powerful donors have a kind of access that most Americans don't to governors or to members
right.
of Congress is extraordinarily troubling. And the reasons are clear, and I don't think it's a big surprise, but to hear it through that phone call, just the familiarity and the instant access that he received when Democrats couldn't reach him, I think was very disturbing. The problem is, even when we have moments like this, rarely do we do things about issues like campaign finance and the underlying processes through which our political system works. But, you know, there's been a lot of writing about those the Koch brothers, and they're coordinating with the Republican leadership nationally, but now at the state level as well. And there you heard it. Prank call. But Governor Walker wasn't wondering who he was, and he was more than willing to talk to him for a while about the particularities of his strategy.
Mm-hmm.
But this is something both parties are guilty of. And again, if we don't do anything about how campaign finance works, the reality is politicians will always need money and people who could mobilize votes that way.
And then, if you lived in Wisconsin, you would be amazed, or maybe you wouldn't because you follow this closely, but the number of ads that both sides have put on television is absolutely astounding, the amount of money that's being spent in this state trying to persuade people to one opinion or another.
No, absolutely. It's become a national issue, and the way in which you fight issues in this day and age is by running ads, which cost money, which, you know, lead political advocates to rely on wealthy donors. So it's a horrible cycle in which a small, concentrated number of people get disproportionate amount of power because they could fund these things. It's also going to lead to the situation where many people in Wisconsin will start to feel maybe a little like people in the Middle East, that others are now making this territory their issue. And it could backfire that way, again, left and right, that Republicans and Democrats now want to use Wisconsin for their own fights, rather than this being a battle and a debate about Wisconsin's budget, which is really where it started.
Mm-hmm. Lyric, is it from Blanchardville? Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Two quick questions. One is about the budget repair bill, that there's a line item that Governor Scott Walker can sell Wisconsin Public Utilities in no-bid contracts with him deciding on the price. And I'm concerned about any Wisconsin. Do we have nuclear energy plants? Is this legal? And the second question is, the two Fitzgerald brothers, one is in charge of the Republicans in the House and one is in charge of the Republicans in the Senate, I believe. And I heard a rumor, and I don't know if it's true, that their father was put in charge of the state police by Governor Walker. Is that legal?
That is true. It's not a rumor. It's illegal.
Okay. You're delving into kind of the level of Wisconsin politics I don't know about. So I'd hesitate on both of those to answer. But I have heard, you know, one of the things we see when Republican executives, governors or presidents make a strong push is it's often coupled with empowering the person in the executive branch. We saw this at the national level with George Bush. Big push against certain kinds of government, and doing that by making the executive stronger and able to essentially circumvent the legislature and make decisions. And it's kind of this paradox of conservatism. You want to empower part of the government in an effort to cut it. Ronald Reagan did the same. So it's not surprising if especially point one is true. And this is a big push for aggrandizing executive power in Wisconsin that is something we've seen from conservative government-cutting Republicans in the past.
More phone calls in a moment. Professor Julian Zelizer is our guest this hour of the program. He joins us, and we're always happy when he does, frequently on this program. Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University, he's a presidential scholar as well, has written many books on presidents, and also is author of Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. More phone calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program this Tuesday, Ruth Brandon, will join us. She's the author of Ugly Beauty, Helena Rubinstein, L'Oreal, and the Blemished History of Looking Good. Ruth is from England. She's a cultural historian and biographer who's written a number of books, and this is an absolutely fascinating tale on so many fronts in terms of beauty in the industry and the amount of money in the industry and politics and Nazi sympathizers, and it's all woven into a fascinating read. So she will join us hour number two. Professor Julian Zelizer is here now. Tim in Turtle Lake is next. Hi, Tim.
It's Jim, but thank you. Anyway.
Hi, Jim.
I just can't believe how this is turning into a class war, almost. Like, it seems like the rich and powerful in this country just want to just step on our throat and not allow, what's the ideology? I mean, the Koch brothers are billionaires. Why do they... Well, what do they want it to be? They want all the money. I mean, when 4% or 5% of the people in the country have, 80 or 90% of the wealth, I'm not sure exactly what it is. Why aren't people, how workers are fighting against other workers now when there's billionaires are just laughing all the way to the bank? I mean, it's just amazing to me that this goes on.
Professor.
Well, it's funny. That's the feeling that has lurked, and I think it's part of what animated the Tea Party, not just Democrats. The notion that inequality has been increasing in the past three decades dramatically, that the middle class has been eroding, and that public policy has tended to support this. And I think, you know, again, some of the Tea Party sentiment was fueled by that the TARP and the Wall Street bailout was unfair. And we were bailing out Wall Street, but we weren't bailing out homeowners.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, what Walker is doing is shifting attention to the Republican Party with this. And by, again, conflating the budget reform with collective bargaining, many people are looking at the Republicans and saying this is, in fact, a class war. It's an attempt to undercut unions, which, you know, have benefited middle-class Americans for many decades now. And so that's the issue Republicans are putting on the table. And I think that's why people are very worked up nationally, even people who might be Republican in many elections, who come from families that depend on what their union can obtain, are quite upset.
And why is it that we weren't as upset? Because it was such a big thing, Professor Julian Zelizer, for us to bail out a lot of Wall Street crooks who were preying on poor people in this country. Then we bailed them out with a lot of our tax money, and they got these huge bonuses, and they're back at it fat and happy again. Where was our righteous anger there?
Well, there was some there, and it went to the Tea Party. But in general, people accepted it. I think part of it was not understanding all the details, and it was in the middle of a frightening crisis where I don't think people followed all the minutia of what was happening. And there is this idea in American political history, not of class warfare, but a belief that all people can ultimately rise up. And many Americans who are, you know, in the Depression, there's famous polls where a huge percentage of Americans considered themselves to be in the middle class. And very frequently, middle-class Americans are fine with wealthier people becoming rich and hope one day they will enjoy that. And I think the TARP could be accepted under those conditions, under that logic, whereas this is actually taking money away from middle-class Americans. So it's very different. It's not about allowing the wealthy to be wealthy and hopefully the rest of us. This is about saying, we're going to pay for the budget on your back. Mm-hmm. And I think that's some of the anger you're hearing that didn't exist a few years ago.
Thanks, Tim. Dan in Three Lakes. Hi.
Good morning. Naturally, I have much to say, but I'm going to confine myself an awful lot. We simply can't deny that the fix we're in came from decades of irresponsible government and governors and legislatures that raided funds like the Highway Fund, the Medical Malpractice Fund, blew the tax, the tobacco funds, all of these things just to balance the budget for a single biennium. If the penalty for doing that, it was the death penalty for the legislature and governors that voted for it, none of our existing living governors or past governors would be alive.
Professor Zelizer.
Well, I don't think he's alone. I mean, there is often a frustration with state government and a sentiment that this is a mess they made through either corruption or playing with the books. You hear the same thing in states like New Jersey. But the question is what to do about it, and the question is how to prevent it from becoming a problem again. Now, those are two separate issues. But I do think, and it's different even than you see on the national level. At the state level, there is this belief that politicians have made this mess. And I think the issue is how do you go through the budget and not make one sector pay for fixing that problem and try to really spread the fix and make it as equitable as possible.
Thanks, Dan. Tom in Burlington, hi.
We have a million senior citizens have had to leave Wisconsin because they can't pay the high property school taxes and police taxes we have here. And it's all based upon, we don't have a sales tax to pay for our schools, but it's just very disingenuous of Mr. Walker to put the entire burden on the school teachers and exclude the police departments.
Wait, what about a sales tax? Do a lot of states use that to make things easier for their citizens, Professor?
Well, there's been not just a sales tax. I mean, and I don't know exactly how Wisconsin's revenue generation is divided up. But in general, you have not heard much about new sources of revenue and raising taxes.
Right.
You know, you hear that's how you balance the budget. You cut spending, but you also raise taxes. And I think that's just been off the table in the states we're talking about with these Republican governors. But I do think it's actually, you know, going to be something that the states have to reckon with, either new forms of taxes like sales taxes or increasing the ones that exist. Because, again, the services we're talking about are services many in these states depend on. No one wants to see their schools gutted just to balance the budget.
Mm-hmm. Well, all right, let's talk about where everything is going. Where is all of this going? Because this state can't continue to function this way. Schools need to know how much money they're going to have, how much money will be not in the budget. People who are on Medicaid need to know their futures. We need to know our future. So what's the end game?
Well, there will be a resolution. All these states are going to come up with fixes. They are going to be very steep in terms of cuts. I do think we're entering a period 5-10 years where you're going to see very big, significant cuts in state spending and state services. And that will be the new normal. I think that's just what's going to happen. There might be some increase in revenue, but right now none of the governors are even talking about that. So I think you're going to see a reduction, you know, a reversal of what much of the 20th century was about, cuts in government. And I think we're going to learn to expect less from government, and we might pay the costs of that in terms of, you know, education, in terms of safety. But that's what's going to happen. And I don't think there's any way around that if you're not putting taxes on the table and you're saying that taxes have to be cut or everyone's going to flee the state. And unless the federal government steps in and provides assistance, that's what we face.
Well, that's a real catch-22, isn't it? Because you can't progress. You can't make more money and have all these new ideas if you cut education and you're not as educated as you used to be. How do you advance?
No, you can't. I think those are the costs. The institutions that the money funds are the institutions these states need. You know, do you want to get rid of the University of Wisconsin, which has been this phenomenal institution in terms of generating ideas and students, in the process of balancing the budget? That will have costs to Wisconsin. Same in California. You know, do you want to get rid of UC Berkeley, a jewel in our public education system, to balance the budget? There's huge costs to that. So I think if we go down this route, I think the costs will be quite high, from lower, you know, primary education through higher education to other services, making cities, you know, unsafe and unhealthy. Those are the costs we're going to face.
Yeah. Well, that was a sad note, but I sure always like to talk to you. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Our guest this hour, Professor Julian Zelizer. The hour just goes by so fast when he's on, doesn't it? We're so engaged. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We have news coming up, and we'll return.